Salut, moi c'est Guillaume Hachet. Bienvenue dans 70 minutes avec. Pour ce premier numéro, j'ai eu la chance d'interviewer Alexander De Croo, le vice-premier ministre belge et ministre de l'agenda numérique. On a parlé pendant une heure de sujets comme l'intelligence artificielle, le manque de femmes dans la tech en Belgique, l'inertie de l'enseignement obligatoire. Pour que cette interview soit accessible au plus grand nombre, j'ai décidé de la faire en anglais et j'ai aussi mis un transcript dans les notes de l'émission. Bonne écoute! Welcome everyone, welcome to the show. I'm here with my very first guest ever, Alexander De Croo. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you please perhaps introduce yourself for those who don't know you?
Alexander De Croo. I'm a Belgian Deputy Prime Minister. I'm also Minister for what is called the Digital Agenda, so for the Digital Revolution. I'm also Minister for Development Cooperation, which is a completely different topic. But there is a strong junction between those two, because if you look at development efforts throughout the world, digital actually plays a very important role in that.
Mm-hmm. That was actually the context for which we went to the United Nations back in September.
Well, but something which is called Digital for Development is something in which Belgium has invested a lot over the last years, and I think that the digital investments, especially in Africa, are today the most important investments that have ever taken place there, and that hold the most promise for finally lifting a maximum number of people out of poverty.
Awesome. Well, we're going to talk about all that. But before we really get into it, let's start off with kind of a silly question. You are Belgium's first ever Minister of Digital Agenda. You very clearly care very passionately for topics like innovation, entrepreneurship, AI, women in tech. And it might also be worth mentioning that you are also rocking a Google Pixel 2 as your main smartphone. So, Mr. De Croo, let's get this out of the way. Are you one of us? Are you a nerd?
Let's call it geek.
Okay.
Which is maybe a bit more middle of the road. But
right.
Yes, as a kid, I remember when I think I was 12 years old. So that was beginning of the 80s. My parents, who have a law office, installed a small computer network. And what I was doing is that I was always watching over the shoulder of the technicians installing it, taking notes of what they were doing, and then doing it myself afterwards. And so I've always been involved with technology and fiddling and playing with PCs and so on. And though I have been for a long, long time a fan of BlackBerry, and for a long time continued using a BlackBerry even when the smartphones were coming, well, at some point I understood that I needed to move. And yes, I'm a fan.
When did you do the switch?
I think I did the switch, must have been 2011 or something. I think
okay.
I stuck.
I think it was still okay. But
I stuck with buttons for a long, long, long time, and then I made the switch to to typing on glass. But I like the Android system, and when a new Google phone comes out, in general, I try to get it. And now this one, to get the Pixel 2, I had to parallel import it from through the UK, I think.
All right, then. Is it fair to say that you are Belgium's first ever geek minister?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's not the main characteristic, but
no,
I have a strong interest in technology, and I use it a lot.
Right.
And I believe that there is a story that needs to be told more often, is that in general, technology improves our lives. Though there are side effects which we need to handle, in general, technology is a positive thing. And the whole mindset in Europe that you have today, where there is actually some anxiety towards technology and there is a lot of negative thinking around technology, is, I think, is a big issue. We don't have to be naive, but we have to be quite clear on the positive impact that technology can have in our lives.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of striking the gap between politicians and technology. You don't always see an overlap. You don't always see politicians actually talking about technology, talking about topics like artificial intelligence. And We've been seeing some of that those past few years, for instance, with you talking a lot about artificial intelligence and those topics. Emmanuel Macron as well has been really focused on the topic of AI. We're gonna get back to that in a moment, but before we get into that, before you got into politics, you were in a startup yourself. You were an entrepreneur yourself. You've been arguing that governments should adopt a more entrepreneurial mindset, and that this is something that was lacking today. How do you personally feel that your entrepreneurial mindset has affected your career as a politician and maybe like this current administration as a whole?
Well, I think there is a more analogies than people think between being an entrepreneur and being a politician. Because in the end, as an entrepreneur, at the start, the first people you will convince, the first products that you will sell, very often it is much more based on you as a person than on exactly the product or the service you have developed. It's very often putting yourself as a person on the line, which is something you do in politics all the time. In politics, yes, we do have our programs and we do have our ideas and so on, but in the end, it's still a very personal, people-based thing. And that is something quite recognizable with the entrepreneurial world. Now, there are some big differences as well. And the big difference in politics, of course, is that, especially in Belgium, you have to find consensus around certain ideas, and the pace is much, much slower. Now, I think that governments or public service should, when we today say that we want people to be more entrepreneurial, well, maybe we have to be more entrepreneurial ourselves as well. And instead of sometimes having lengthy discussions about what might happen, we should maybe just work more in this sandbox type of approach where we test out certain things, where we know that it's okay to fail, but at least we have tried something out instead of getting stuck in very long discussions.
Mm-hmm. But so given your entrepreneurial background, given your kind of mindset that you have, I mean, concretely, like, is there something, an example you can give us of something that you think you would not have done had you not had this entrepreneurial experience?
Well, there's a few things. First of all, I've spent 10 years outside of politics, mm-hmm. and that gives me a lot of independence. I mean, I love what I do as a politician, and I would love to continue doing it. But the day that I will not find the energy or that I will not find the impact that I want to have, I know that there's a lot of other things I can do. And that gives me a lot of independence in a political world where I think it's much easier to defend my ideas, knowing that I am actually quite independent. Second element is obviously that I have a feel for opportunity. And this is, I think, what distinguishes an entrepreneur from someone who's not thinking as an entrepreneur, is that what entrepreneurs do is they see the same as what other people see, but their first reaction is, we can do this better and have a better solution for this, and I have something that is more convenient or more adapted to the needs of people. And that, I think, is something that as a politician you need to have, and it's something that we lack often in Belgium, is this sense of ambition and the sense of doing things better and not being happy with the status quo.
All right. A couple of months ago, it made the news that of all the money that was raised by Belgian startups, I think the total was around 327 million euros for 2017. Mm-hmm. It made the news that only 8% of that money was raised by Walloon startups. Mm-hmm. So it kind of becomes apparent that there's sort of an entrepreneurial divide here in Belgium where, you know, only 8% of the money was raised in Wallonia. What does that say really about Belgium? And
I think we should honestly stop to divide our country in three. And honestly, I don't care that much, because I can imagine that you will have people who grew up in Wallonia, went to university in Brussels, and then maybe started a company in Antwerp. Now, what is that? Then in the statistics, we will say, oh, this is money being raised in Antwerp. But then from my perspective, we're all Belgians, and I'm not a big fan of the tribalism that some people are trying to instill in Belgium. The good news, I think, is that a lot of money is being raised. The good news is that you see kind of hubs being created throughout Belgium. That finally being an entrepreneur is seen as something aspirational, and that a lot of young people actually aspire to be an entrepreneur, and that has been different in Belgium in the past, so we can only be happy with that.
More on that. I think back to what you were just saying just now, Belgians have this kind of reputation that they don't really like taking risks. Maybe that is something that's starting to change. But like according to Eurostat, like the business birth rate, the company creation rate for Belgium is around like 3.6%, which is like the lowest in Europe. In a way, one might say that, like you were saying, like entrepreneurs are kind of a rare species around here. Mm-hmm. Do you think that is something that will change? Do you think that is something that is already changing, maybe? And how do we provoke this change? How do we share this mindset and encourage young people to start a business? Like, what is the key to that?
I think that first of all, you need some good role models, and we start to have those role models. And I often say it when I speak in front of an entrepreneurial crowd: is if you want, you cannot let the discussion about our economy or about entrepreneurship, you cannot just leave it to politicians. You need to be part of that debate as well. And if you want entrepreneurship to be respected, don't hesitate to go on stage yourself. And I have two young kids, they're 6 and 9, and obviously they're very inspired by our national football team, which is great. And why are they inspired by the national football team? Because they see how good they are. I would love that when they're 16-year-old, they will see how good our entrepreneurs are, and that they get inspired by our entrepreneurs as well. I think this is one element. Second element is that obviously, as an employee in Belgium, you have a quite good situation. Some people will call it the golden cage, and it's true. It's not so easy to say goodbye to the employee status and to say I will start from zero and take a lot of risk. I remember that when I did that, a lot of my friends said, well, you're stupid. I mean, why have you done it this way? You could have a much better life.
I've had this experience as well, so I can relate.
So it's that's what I often say to people who say, well, one day we'll be an entrepreneur. I tell them, well, don't wait too long. If you want to do it, then you should do it right now, because the longer you wait, the harder it is going to be to leave the financial stability and the financial security which you have as an employee. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. This is kind of a very like personal question, a very personal example, but I have actually started to visit schools and to actually talk about entrepreneurship and what it's like and what it means, what it does to you as a person. So far, it's been kind of a great experience, but it's been kind of tainted by the fact that whenever I get in touch with a school that's in the general section, you can feel that they're not very receptive at all. Like they don't understand what we're talking about. And like the very first question they ask is, "Oh, but we don't really have a computer class here," and so you have to explain that it's about entrepreneurship, that it's about tracing your own path, and then they tell you, "Oh, that maybe for the." The economics class, economical sciences, and they're really not that receptive to the message, and it's kind of hard to actually reach those kids and deliver the message to them. So again, this is a very personal question, but what is the way you would suggest taking to reach those kids?
Yeah, I'm not so sure that classes about entrepreneurship have the biggest impact. I think what has the most impact is to just show people what entrepreneurs are doing. And so very often we will talk about the fact that we need to have internships for kids and so on. And I think that's a good thing. That can definitely help. But what would also help is that when our teachers would also do internships, because our teachers are very often quite far away from the economic reality, and that explains, I think, part of the answers that you have gotten. Today there is too much of a gap between the educational world and the entrepreneurial world, and you see it in the typical high schools. But you also see it in other domains. I mean, if today we will talk about artificial intelligence and so on, there is in Belgium today not one decent university degree on artificial intelligence. I mean, that is appalling. I don't understand why there is not more reactivity from our universities, even in big data. And big data is, I mean, we've been talking about it for some years now. It's quite hard to find a university specialization in big data. Right. No one is providing it today.
So there's a gap, a growing gap.
There's a gigantic gap, and our universities are really lacking this kind of responsive answer in that domain. Yeah.
All right. Well, more on that. Let's talk about AI for a bit. I think it's pretty fair to say that our current economy, our current system, is built around the idea of human labor. You know, people work and they get paid for it. With the rise of AI technologies, it's becoming more and more apparent that this is something that's probably about to change. Like the status quo is about to change a lot. We're talking about a revolution that would affect like healthcare, economy, democracy, and we're still hearing fairly little about it from our politicians. Like I don't hear Charles Michel talking about it. I don't hear the Minister of Economy in Brussels or in Wallonia talking about it. Mm-hmm. Or maybe they did, but I didn't hear it. How do you explain this? This absence.
Well, I think that there is some talking about it, but again, too often on the negative side. So on. This is going to destroy jobs. We have to be careful about the ethical dimension, and we should see it as a threat. Where I think we should have the opposite approach. First of all, does that mean that work is going to disappear? No, not at all. I don't believe that story at all. And I hear those stories where we say, well, there's no meaningful work that will remain, and so the only solution is to give everyone a universal basic income. I do not believe in universal basic income at all, and I'm happy that the experiment in Finland has basically proven that it is not a viable option. The problem is that I'm not against the fact that you give people a certain allowance, but giving it without any productive dimension to it, I think, is wrong. So that is why we developed, together with the World Economic Forum, something else, which is the Universal Right to Learn, which basically is a reskilling program where you can give people a certain income, but in exchange for reskilling. I mean, you need at least to have some productivity improvement element to it. Otherwise, economically, it doesn't make sense at all. Now, on AI, AI is just going to be like a lot of other technologies. It is a tool that we use, and it's probably going to be a quite powerful tool, but still it remains a tool, and the tool is complementary to our skills. And so I think that the real question we should ask is, when you are in times of machine learning, the question is, then maybe we should learn what machines will not learn on the short term. And do I think that AI today, especially in well-defined environments, yes, has a lot of potential. A potential, and it's partly already there. I mean, we're still far away from replacing our capability of complex problem solving, our capability on innovation and creativity, and our capabilities on emotions and on empathy and so on. So I believe that in an AI world, probably we will in our education system emphasize much more the very human elements. Very often when we speak about how to change education in the fourth industrial revolution, people talk about smart boards and tablets and so on. I'm not so convinced about that. I don't think that's the solution. I think the solution, if you want everyone to be able to have value added as a person in an AI world, is to just focus much more on the very human elements. And that is a bit of contradiction.
Mm-hmm. The education system has been kind of very slow to evolve. And like sometimes I look at schools and I kind of wonder if they've really changed compared to what they were like 30 years ago.
And no, they haven't. That's what I see it every day with my kids go to the same school where I went X years ago. And that can give you a warm feeling to go back to your own school, but it gives me less of a warm feeling to see that not that much has changed, unfortunately. And what I have noticed is that change in education is very slow. And there's a number of good reasons why it is slow. Now, we can say, oh, it's slow and it's a problem. Or we could use another approach, which is what we are doing in Belgium, is to say, well, let's then do things outside of the educational system to at least prove that things are possible. And this is what we did with the Digital Skills Fund, where we fund 40 projects every year. It's 6 million euros every year that we invest in projects that are combining digital and education, but that are outside of the schools. A lot of them are quite successful. My feeling is that we will prove outside of the schools that they work, and once we have proven that, I hope that the schools will take them back inside at some point.
All right.
Because I think that all those initiatives are great. They have one big drawback, is that there is a social filter. We will send our kids there because we know it's important, but people who have no interest in technology will not send their kids there, and that's a problem. The general school system is one gigantic social equalizer, and that's a good thing. So the current system of doing it outside of the schools, it's better than nothing, but it has some issues.
Let's get back to AI for a bit. It made the news that China and the United States have been making a lot of progress in the field of AI, and fairly little is happening in Europe.
Yes, that's
and
true.
Because of the very important place of AI in our future, or at least the perspectives we have right now, some fear that this means we will become very dependent on China and on the United States as a culture, mm-hmm. as a society. Do you agree with this sentiment, and how do we prevent this from happening?
I think that if you look at the state of play today, yes. There's, especially United States, China, and Israel are the places where things are happening in AI. And it's different models. I mean, the US and the Chinese model is very different. One is state-driven, the other is less so. And the Israeli system is driven by their military investment. Still, we see that some public investment plays a role everywhere. And so I think that in Europe, now is the moment, and I think that Macron talked about it, mm-hmm. to create a common investment pool for AI. Though we have some backlog on it, Europe has an interesting environment to experiment with AI. And that is because AI is working on data. And there is a lot of discussion about GDPR, but I consider that GDPR is a good thing, because GDPR is coming to a balanced agreement between the public and economic actors on how to use data. And so finding a balanced way of how to handle data, I think, is the basic condition for making AI work in an acceptable way. And so I think that Europe has better done its groundwork in what the environment is, but has some backlog in the technology itself. But at least the groundwork, I think, is a better one. I fear that a lot of things that have been happening throughout the world in AI are interesting, but you could lose the buy-in of the public quite rapidly, and that would be a problem.
Right. So a lot of groundwork has been done in terms of legislation, in terms of preparing for this revolution, at least on the European side. But back to what you were saying earlier in terms of education, in terms of mm-hmm. Academia. According to the OECD, in Belgium, there's only 1.1% of our students who are studying ICT.
Yes.
And that is the lowest ratio in the entire list of OECD countries. It seems like studying computing isn't exactly all the rage here in Belgium. As the Minister of Digital Agenda, how do you explain mm-hmm. that? And also, in a world driven by AI, isn't this a massive problem, the fact that we're not producing a lot of computing experts?
I think it's, yes, I mean, it's a problem that we are that low. Of course, you have to look at it a bit broader. If you look at people who are active in ICT today, well, a lot of them actually did not study computer sciences, but a lot of them studied civil engineering, studied other types of hard science, and then made the transition into the information technology world. So, yes, that statistic is a worrying one, but if you look at it in a broader sense and you look at all STEM educations, there the situation is not that dramatic. Still, there's a huge effort to be done to convince more people that studying in STEM topics is a good thing, and especially for girls, and we'll talk about it later, I guess. It is today, I think, the main hurdle we see in digitization today is access to people. Mm-hmm. And then I guess that a sensible way of organizing migration could be a solution. And it is a discussion which is a very delicate one in Belgium today.
Sure.
But the talent migration is something for which we too often close our doors, and we are wrong in doing that, I think.
You mentioned one of the main points I want to talk about today, which is women in tech, women in computer sciences. We don't produce a lot of computer scientists, but among those, we don't have a lot of women. I think the percentage of women students in ICT for Belgium is around 7.2%, which, good news or bad news, is also the lowest percentage in the OECD. So in that case too, Belgium is ranking last. How do you explain that? How do you explain the very low participation of women in ICT, in digital, in computer science?
Well, I think that what you explain about Belgium is a general phenomenon. Some countries do it better. I see, for example, some Eastern European countries do it actually a lot better than Belgium. But it's a general issue, and the general issue, actually, if you look in history, at the beginning of computer sciences, the problem was not there. There were actually a lot of women active in computer science in the 60s and in the 70s. That changed at some point due to the personal computer, because the personal computer brought it to the homes and gave this little geeky side to it. Mm-hmm. Because you would have, just like I was, 12-year-olds fiddling with PCs.
Oh, so it is your fault.
It is, maybe. Well, I was part of it. You would have 12-year-olds fiddling with PCs, and at that point, for girls, that is not an attractive thing to do. They are busy with other things.
Is it not?
Also because of bias, because of gender bias, which we install in a number of
the so-called Hollywood depiction of hackers and of geeks.
Exactly, but so that image is not an attractive one to girls, and girls get conditioned through bias in a very different way, which means that when you would have girls going to university at the age of 18-year-old, they have a backlog compared to boys who have been playing with these things. And so it there's a strong rejection. Now, there has been techniques used in that to attract other profiles into information technological studies. For example, at MIT today, which is quite a hard one to get into, in the beginning, the first steps of programming is using Scratch, which is something made for kids.
Sure.
But using Scratch makes it a bit less geeky at the start and easier to grasp the general concepts that are being used. So I would think that in Belgium, this is what we need to do. We need to make it more practical, more fun, less of a geeky thing. And what I see is when I visit the Coder Dojos and the others is that we see gigantic progress. I mean, there's a lot of girls there, and that's a good thing. Now, today they are between 6 and 12, but that will flow through in the years to come.
Sure. And so what's kind of very apparent, I had kind of the same thought process as you, which is that, you know, when I look at an auditorium of computer scientists at ULB, I can see very clearly the pathway they took from playing video games on their computer when they were fairly young to learning PHP when they were 14, and then really getting into it, and then identifying as a nerd, as a geek. And so, Yeah, the entryway to this geekiness, to this computing world, is a boy's gateway. Mm-hmm. And some have argued, like you do, that adding programming classes, that adding programming to the education world would add a new gateway that would be universal.
I think so. And there, I mean, there's some surprising things. If I remember that when I was in high school, and so that was beginning of the 90s, I learned how to code. And I learned, I think it was Turbo Pascal.
Okay.
And that gave us good basis of what coding is. And I remember that
was in high school.
That was in high school, yes. Wow. That was in high school. And I remember that, so the exam was on paper. So you basically wrote programming code on paper and then handed out, which is a bit of a strange thing. And I loved it. I liked it. And I think I was, well, I was quite good at it. And now, if I look at the same school today, and I asked it to the director recently, they don't do it anymore. They don't teach coding. So in the 90s, we did it.
Yeah.
And today we don't. Which
how do you explain this?
It's impossible for me to explain that. Now, one of the things that I have often said is that if you look at our school system in Belgium, the way we basically test kids on their what they call capability of abstract thinking is that very often today that is still done through Latin and through maths. I mean, I did that too. I did 4 years of Latin. I thought it was horrendous.
I did 6 years of Latin. I thought it was great.
Okay, well, then you have different views on that. And obviously, yes, it helps you because it gives you a basis of the language which determined our culture. But in the end, why do so many people force their kids into Latin? Because they know that this is kind of how you get being stimulated in a certain way. But it also rejects a lot of kids, and it rejects a lot of kids, first of all, because they consider it something unuseful. And very often also a lot of parents who have not been exposed to Latin very often will say, well, why would you do that? It's a dead language. Why would you even bother? I would think that you can achieve exactly the same testing of abstraction capability with programming languages. It's exactly the same. I mean, it's in the end, it's an abstract structure that you use for certain things, and it's much more useful. Now, I've said that at some occasions, and then I got some angry reactions from Latin teachers. I'm not saying that Latin should disappear. I'm just saying that coding could be another way of testing that, and could be a way that appeals to much more kids than the way it's done today,
including girls.
Including girls, yes.
Interesting. More on that. On the French-speaking side, they are working on this massive reform that I think will only impact high schools at the end of the next decade. I think around 2027 or something.
Yeah.
And one of the first thing they announced was that Latin would become mandatory for everyone until the age of 15. And in terms of digital, they want to include a digital aspect to teach a digital culture and all that. But as soon as you start talking about algorithmics, talking about programming, there's still a lot of debate on that front. A lot of lobbying has been done, a lot of pro and anti programming classes. I guess that's the same question I was asking earlier. How do you explain this?
I think this need to
not be okay with programming and think that it's such a bad idea when...
I don't know. I mean, there's a few elements. First of all, in Flanders also we have these educational reforms, and it takes a gigantic amount of time because there's lobbying in all directions, and it's a hard thing to do. And I think it's actually the wrong approach, because we are trying to define what we think that kids should learn, and it should be a stable environment for the next 10, 15 years. I'm not sure we can actually define that, because we live in such a rapidly changing world.
Right.
I am much more in favor of giving the schools much more autonomy in that, and letting the schools fill it in themselves, and giving the teachers much more autonomy in that. Today, teachers are basically being transformed into some teaching robots who are good when they fulfill the administration. that's not why you became a teacher. I mean, people didn't become a teacher to fill out the administration. They became a teacher because they have a passion to teach something to kids. And giving them more freedom, I think, is actually something that will lead to better quality education than the way it is being organized today. Now, on coding and so on, there is a lot of conservative in this. I think there is also a total lack of knowledge in what the possibilities are. And a lot of thinking like, well, you know, but coding is only going to be for a certain part of the population. But computational thinking is the element that we should have, is to at least give people a sense of the structure of these things and how it is being done. I find it, come back to my example, really, really strange that if I compare it to, for example, my kids, I was at school almost at this age closer to computers than they have been up to now, which is really, really strange, I think.
You were talking just now about giving more freedom to schools, and earlier you were talking about the fact that you have chosen to act, or actually, is it really a choice to act outside of the school system with your digital skills fund? Let me speak my mind for a second here. Our political system works in such a layered and modular way that here you are deputy prime minister, and you don't really have a say over what goes on in our schools, and so you feel that it's a good thing to have this laboratory outside of the school system to experiment and to then convince schools to include programming, but you don't really have a choice in that matter because you are not schools are not part of your jurisdiction, so to say.
That's true. Now, in the end, we're not the only country where it's organized that way.
Okay.
I mean, it's the same in Germany, and I mean, in a lot of countries that are federal countries, education is decentralized. So it would be easier if everything is federal, but then there's also some issues which you would have. So I think what is crucial is that you work together and you have ministers of education have the same ideas. And that's also part of the effort that I should do. I see a lot of good developments taking place, at least in Flanders, where I have more of you on it. And as I said before, I mean, change in education is slow because it's a people business and it's about kids' future, and it's not an environment where it's easy to experiment because no one wants to experiment with their kids. So very often it remains a very conservative world.
So the key to having more girls, more women in computing is to have programming in schools. Mm-hmm. But schools are very conservative and very slow to change and very they have a lot of inertia.
It depends.
So it's not going to happen very quickly.
Well, it depends. It depends. I mean, you see some schools where it does happen. And that's the point I want to make about giving schools more autonomy. What you see, in the end, it will happen when you have motivated teachers and motivated school directors. And giving them more freedom will help. And you see that you have some schools that are doing very interesting things which are in parallel to the official curriculum that they should follow. My feeling is, if you give the schools more autonomy, a lot of things will happen. And it's one of the debates that we have today is how much autonomy can you give schools, especially in this domain?
We only have about 10 minutes left. During your first mandate as the Minister of Digital Agenda, you've introduced, among other things, new legislation around open data, a tax shelter for startups, fiscal measures for the circular economy, and your digital skills funds. If your party fares well in the next elections, which are the challenges that you would like to take up next as the Minister of Digital Agenda?
I'm not sure I will be Minister of Digital Agenda again. I mean, I would love to, but it's not clear cut today. I think that one of the main elements is our taxation system in a digital world. Our taxation system has been made in an industrial world, and the technical way we tax and the basis which we tax, I think, is becoming more and more obsolete. Today, we tax corporate profit, but corporate profit is quite hard to define in a digital world, and it's a very volatile thing in this global economy. And we are not using technology enough to simplify taxes and to make it much more fair. One of the, you talked about the taxation system for the circular economy. What we use is a very easy system. We said instead of asking you to fill out all types of forms, we just ask the platforms every 3 months to give us a download of all the transactions that happened, and we'll just tax 5% on it. This is a very efficient way of taxing. There's no way to avoid it. It's a broad base and a small percentage, and it doesn't cost us anything because it's basically being done by the platforms. And so changing our taxation much more in such a way by using the technology that you have and doing it much more transaction-based than the way it's being done today, I think is one of the main one of the main challenges, and could make Belgium an interesting testing ground for all types of innovation, as you see that some countries are doing today. In the end, in the world of today, being big or small doesn't make that much of a difference. It's being fast that makes a difference. If as a country you are fast and you create legislation,
which goes back to what we're saying about the entrepreneurial mindset for politics.
Exactly. Yeah, and that is a role that a country like Belgium can play. We can try to be fast and to be the place where testing out things can happen because we were first in having a regulation.
All right. I have to mention this. A 10,000 pages long report came out last week saying that Telenet, Proximus, and VOO had a significant place on the market and needed to be, more open, mm-hmm. and just overall more open to competition. The decision now lies in the hand of the European Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Using the internet here in Belgium is much, much more expensive than in neighboring countries like France. What are you hoping will come out of this, and what are your plans to? Yeah, how do we change this situation?
Well, maybe a few elements. First of all, the quality of our internet is outstanding, and all right. So any comparison that you will see, Belgium will be top three in Europe on the quality and on the availability of very high internet speeds. That's the first element. Second element, yes, we are definitely not the cheapest country in Europe. But if you compare it with France and others, you have to look at the total cost of telecom and not just the promotional tariffs that you see very, very often. So it's a different dynamic. Still, I consider that we need more competition in Belgium. And this report makes it quite clear. There's three elements which I think are important in the report. First of all, the third-party access. So this is others using the network to provide commercial services.
So, for instance, like maybe Orange.
Like Orange is doing today.
Yeah, fiber optic network from.
Well, and Orange today is using the Telnet and the VOO network to provide their fixed services.
Going back to the fiber network that Proximus had,
mm-hmm.
do you think Orange should have access to that as well?
Well, so that's one of the three elements. So, first one is on the cable access. The regulator provides a way of having a lower cost of access, and which is calculated in a better way. And this is a good thing. It will provide more space for commercial innovation by Orange. Second element is that now it will also force to give third-party access for internet only. And this is a very important element, because today, if Movistar is using the network or Orange is using the network of Telnet, it has to take the triple play product. Whereas today, a lot of people are not interested in triple play. A lot of people say, just give me internet and I will stream anything I want. I do not want digital television, and I definitely don't want fixed landlines. And so this is giving the possibility for other players to provide what they call cord-cutting packages. And the third element is then on fiber, is make it clear that when there's fiber investment, some type of access is required. I think that these are good measures, but we will see how the Commission is looking at it. I think they have 30 days to react. But this together with the auctioning of new spectrum for 4 and 5G, which is going to happen in the next months, could bring a new competitive boost into the Belgium telecom market.
Awesome. All right. We only have like 1 minute left, so let's go for a round of very quick questions.
Yeah.
Who is a celebrity you'd love to meet? That's a very silly
question. That I think it's a good it's a good question. Elon Musk.
All right. It came out, I think, yesterday that he was dating the singer Grimes.
Yes,
I still have not gotten over that.
I have seen that, but okay.
And also, okay, who would you say is your favorite band or artist?
Oh, that's a band called the Pixies.
All right.
Which is something from
my
youth.
I saw them this summer in Paris.
Yep.
Favorite concert you've ever been to?
Yeah, I think in general the big Belgian festivals, Rockwerchter or Pukkelpop, have always been a favorite.
Okay. Where do you see yourself in 5 years, Mr. De Croo?
I have no idea.
Okay.
And the good part about life is that sometimes you need to go with the flow and not try to plan everything.
Awesome. Well, Mr. De Croo, it's been a pleasure.
My pleasure. Good. Thank you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Et voilà, c'est tout pour l'épisode 1. Si la question des femmes en informatique vous a intéressé, sachez que l'épisode suivant, l'épisode 2, est entièrement dédié à ce sujet-là. On reçoit Isabelle Collet de l'Université de Genève et Laure Lemaire de Interface 3. Personnellement, c'est un sujet qui me fascine complètement. Et j'ai d'ailleurs mené cette interview avec Alexander De Croo dans le cadre d'un article que je prépare sur le sujet. Ça s'appelle « Des souris et que des hommes ». Ce sera sur Medium dans pas longtemps. Et je mettrai un lien sur Twitter quand ce sera publié. Pour me suivre sur Twitter, c'est @GuyHachet, j'ai mis un lien dans la description. Et pour ne pas manquer les prochains épisodes de 70 minutes avec, n'oubliez pas de vous abonner sur votre plateforme de podcast préférée. À très bientôt !